Well, COVID is launching all sorts of conspiracy theories and apocalyptic ideas, so it's probably time to look at the impact of plagues throughout history. Now, it's complex, and according to our next guest, pestilence is rarely responsible for the rise and fall of civilizations and empires alone. Investigating how plagues have impacted civilizations in the past has offered Cambridge political economist, John Rapling some clues into the impact of COVID on our world today. And he's written an article called Plagues and Empires: What Can the Decline of the Roman Empire and the End of European Feudalism Tell Us About COVID-19 and the Future of the West? It's published in the philosophy magazine, Eon. John, welcome and thank you very much for your time. One point in history where plague did seem to contribute to profound social change was in 14th century England.
Right, and the interesting thing about the Black Death is that in the English language literature, people say, well, you know, and this is what a lot of economists have said is, well, what it did is because it depleted the labor supply of Europe by as much as a third, it meant that there were just fewer workers, they had more bargaining power, and so they were able to break feudal bonds. And this sounds very compelling when you look at the evidence from England. However, if you look at Europe as a whole, that's not what happened. In fact, feudalism was reinforced, or serfdom was reinforced. And in the initial years after the Black Death, the nobility in England did try to do the same thing, to actually tighten the bonds, precisely because they had less labor available. What happened is that the evolution of English common law over time had created a situation where it actually became more feasible to simply negotiate new forms of tenure. And that is really what...
Enter market forces.
A combination of market forces and also legal, structural, social changes. And the social changes would include the fact that, as you know, much of the English nobility was willing to sort of make the adaptation to move away from being purely a rent-earning landed class to becoming a sort of proto-industrial class by enclosing land and switching to the cultivation of livestock rather than arable farming.
Now, John, you've mentioned this already, but I find the paradox so intriguing. In much of Europe, the Black Death didn't end feudalism, but as you said, actually reinforced it.
That's right. So in Eastern Europe, and of course in Russia, as we know, I mean, you have the continuation of feudalism and of serfdom almost to the end of the 19th century, and a nobility that is absolutely intransigent and refuses to change until it's completely eliminated at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. The English nobility had adapted to that change earlier on. It had to, because, as I say, the particular evolution in the English legal system didn't give it the same sort of powers that its continental counterparts had. It would have liked to have done what they did, it just couldn't.
Is there a lesson in England's plight when it was confronted with the Black Death for policy makers today? Can we apply a lesson or two?
Well, I think if you sort of look at the deep analysis, I think the main insight I get out of it, Philip, is that, first of all, if you have a significant part of society that is essentially a rentier class living off rents and is determined to preserve the value of those rents at all costs, that can, in fact, have a debilitating effect on the economy as a whole. And we saw that in medieval Europe, where the nobility was able to reinforce its ability to collect rents from its serfs. You have economic stagnation, whereas in Europe, the willingness to sort of jettison the old system, which was painful because much of the nobility did go down, was not able to make that adaptation. But where they did, they were able, that sort of revivified the economy. And today, my parallel would be central banks are so determined not to let asset values fall because so much of the society has come to depend upon those rents. And COVID-19, I think that's where it becomes an issue, because central banks and governments have pumped so much money into the economy simply to protect against that sort of fall in asset values. when you could make an argument from the logic of economics that, in fact, at least some fall in asset values in countries where, and Australia would be among them, where, for example, rents have become so high that they're inhibiting the rate of new business formation. So they're actually slowing the economic dynamism in Western societies over the last 20 years. We've had a continual slowdown in the growth rate as a result of this.
John, you must forgive me, but I find economics as mystifying as theology. So let me put this to you. When Western economies were forced into lockdown last year, their governments borrowed, what, $17 trillion in order to keep businesses and consumers afloat? Yes, but this was very different to the responses to the Spanish flu.
It was completely different. Of course, the society was completely different. The big difference between the time of the Spanish flu and today is that at the time of the Spanish flu, 5% or less, depending on the country, of the population of what are today the industrial developed capitalist countries, was retired. Most everybody was still working, and so the economy could rebound quickly. The difficulty today is that in Western societies, on average, a fifth of the population is in that rent-earning category. They are pensioners, and therefore they're not in a position to sort of necessarily re-enter the workforce. But they're also very dependent on the value of the income streams that come from assets. So they're not actually, in a sense, productive assets. A great deal of it is, in fact, in commercial real estate. And that limits the sort of the bounce back. And that's one of the arguments I make in the article, is that developing countries not only have, on average, much younger populations, but they have much less debt. So even though they've been hit harder economically by the pandemic, they will bounce back quicker, despite what the sort of conventional journalistic narrative is. Their longer-term prospects actually look brighter, not in all cases, but in many, if not most.
In looking at the rise and fall of regimes, you say that the problem is not the debt itself, but rather what the debt is used for.
Right, yeah, and that's key. I mean, if you look at public sector debt in developing countries today, by and large, is going into capital investments. This wasn't always the case. It wasn't the case through the 1970s, but it is the case today. Whereas if you look on the huge increase, on average, Western countries added about a fifth to the value of their debt, a quarter to a fifth, you know, an increase. Almost all of it went in support of income. It was designed to either keep people who were unemployed suddenly, you know, to keep their income flowing or to keep businesses still able to operate. So it hasn't actually added to the capital stock of society at all. Now, developing countries simply didn't have the same deep pockets. So by and large, they took on very little debt during the pandemic, which is why the hit was so much greater. But if you look at a country in which I spend a lot of my time, South Africa, it took a 7% hit to the economy, but very little debt. Now, there are Western countries whose the effect of the hit they took from COVID-19 is around that, but they've taken on a fifth of the debt. You know, if they hadn't taken on the debt, the hit would have been far more dire. So that just shows that comparatively, those are more resilient societies.
At the turn of the millennium, the West, that is, developed OECD countries, accounted for, what, four-fifths of the global economic output. Do you see that perhaps as the peak of empire, so to say?
Well, that's definitely the peak. In fact, the year I've calculated, according to my figures, as being the peak of the West is 1999, and that is the year it reaches the highest threshold. And then right around the turn of the millennium, you get a reversal in the direction. And it really has to do with the fact that over the previous two centuries, the flow of income was going from developing world to developed world, going into investments. But since then, you have had a flow going in the opposite direction with outsourcing and the shift of a lot of industrial production to developing countries. And that trend is set to continue.
John, why does debt investment increase output far more in developing countries than in the West?
Well, if you think of what is debt put towards? By and large, in developing countries, a much higher share of the debt is either put in, if it's public sector debt, it's put into infrastructure. If it is private sector debt, it's put into new equipment, new business formation. In developed countries, a huge amount of the debt taken on within society is put into real estate, and not even real estate development, but the flipping of properties, which causes their price to go up. So an individual, what is at an individual level, perfectly rational, someone buys a property in Sydney or wherever, and then sits on it for a few years and sees its value go up, they feel richer, but the economy, they have added absolutely nothing to the output of the economy, other than if they've done some work on the house, they perhaps spent a bit of money. But the house itself produces nothing. It's not a capital asset in that sense. And so we're really pumping an awful lot of money into preserving, as I say, the value of assets. And so you could make a case that if the value of, you know, if the value of the real estate fell, which meant rents came down, it would be easier to start a new business, because so much money now goes in a city like London, so much of your revenue goes into just paying the rent bill. A lot of people can't afford to start new businesses. But the problem with that is that all those property owners will feel themselves much poorer. And that's what makes the politics, the inertia becomes so powerful.
I like the paradox you point out, which holds that the richer the empire becomes, the more it must spend to preserve its wealth. And this, of course, is an echo of what happened before the fall of Rome.
Well, exactly. I mean, what really sort of brought the Roman Empire down is it got bigger and it brought more land under its control. It had more borders to defend. And as it became richer, the gap between it and the inner periphery rose, which means they had to just maintain larger and larger armed forces. And that was draining more and more of the empire's revenue. Today, the parallel would be, you know, you asked about infrastructure in developing countries. In, you know, an African country, you build a railway, you build a road, you build a bridge. It may or may not be in the right place, but it's still a new bridge. Today, most infrastructure investment in Western countries is to repair existing bridges. So it's not adding to society's capital stock. It's not making it more productive. It's maintaining its existing level of productivity.
It should be said that the threat to worst westernize may very likely not come from competition from emerging powers, but rather the threat of authoritarianism within.
Well, yes, I think part of the difficulty, and this is an interesting case where the Roman Empire does give us insights, in the final decades of the Roman Empire, when the barbarian invasions began really sort of eating up land, what you had is two things. You get a fragmentation as different. Everybody starts sort of pulling away in the aristocrats, the nobility of the Roman Empire, who administered day-to-day affairs in the provinces, begin pulling away either to negotiate deals with the incoming armies. You know, I'll keep my position in return of giving the money to the treasury in Rome. I'll give it to you. Or they start sort of banding together to try and fight. You get this fragmentation. And I would say the same thing is happening in the past when Western societies did benefit from that net flow of resources from the periphery.
I have to thank you, John, for improving my dim understanding of these matters. I'm most grateful for your time. And I've been talking to John Rapley, political economist at Cambridge, as well as a senior fellow at the Johannesburg Institute for Advanced Study, and his article, Plagues and Empires, is published in Aeon.